Rabbi.
We are pretty well set now. Cigarettes out, pencils in hand, Bibles ready. Conversation's over. Today I want to deal with the book of Job. And I want to begin by suggesting to you Job is probably that book of the Bible which has most modern appeal. Part of this appeal lies in its magnificent poetry and imagery. But very frankly and honestly, I think most of its attraction is due to its subtle flattery. Job glorifies the indomitable human spirit. It is a paean to man's courage, tamani. Though the heavens conspire against me, though God himself would undermine my self-respect and my judgment, tamani. I am innocent. I hold fast to mine integrity. Job's struggle is to maintain his own self-confidence, his dignity. And he does so against truly overwhelming odds. Even as each of us in his own way or her own way struggles as best she can to uphold dignity and identity, the good and the sense of right, against daily challenge and more than occasionally against serious trauma. Job also fits the modern temper in that it reveals our inner suffering, the tensions, the anxiety which beset modern men. Our modern life has tended to emphasize the brutality, the cruelty, the violence, the bruising, which is part of human existence. Most of us try to put a good face on life. A friend has died young, and in all goodwill, we speak comfort. We try to console him about some suffering, paralysis perhaps, that the dead husband might have been spared. We speak of the comfort which will come from memory. But the one who has suffered knows that though these words are well-intentioned, they are irrelevant and untrue. The fact is, the brutal fact is, that she has suffered cruelly, she is hurt bitterly, and that she must somehow come to grips with life as it really is. Typical of this attitude in Job are these verses. I have heard many such things. Sorry comforters are ye all. Shall windy words not have an end? What provoketh thee that thou answerest? I also could speak as you do if your soul were in my soul's stead. I could join words together against you and shake my head at you. I would strengthen you with my words, and the moving of my lips would assuage your grief. But though I speak, my pain is not assuaged. And though I forbear, what am I eased? The Lord hath torn me in his wrath. He has hated me. He has gnashed upon me with his teeth. Mine adversary sharpened his eyes upon me. They have gaped upon me with their mouth. They have smitten me upon the cheek scornfully. They gather themselves together against me. The modern life has had a tendency to pull the blinders, speech, communication, from human conversation. We tend to look at things a little more deliberately and a little more critically and honestly than did our fathers and our grandfathers. We are clinical. That means that we analyze not only the good intentions of the one who comes to make a condolence call, but its effect. And the book of Job speaks to us a clinical truth, a simple truth, that when we have been hurt, beaten about the head by life, all of the good intentions of our friends cannot put Humpty Dumpty together again. We have to learn to live with the amputation. We have to learn to live beaten, bloodied. We have to learn to start where we are now, to put life together again. And we have to learn to admit that life is indeed a cruel place. To live is to be bruised, and that no one escapes the bruising. Before healing can come, we must face the full measure of our hurt. And Job would add that before we have an adequate philosophy of life, we must learn to accept the galling and the bitter and the galling that it is. In religion, we must learn to accept God not because he is good to us, but simply because he is. Have pity upon me, Job says. Have pity upon me, ye my friends, for the hand of God hath touched me and turned against me. And there follows in this chapter a long chronicle of his bitterness and his pain. And he offers no explanation. He concludes simply, "But as for me, I know that my Redeemer liveth, that he will witness at the last upon the dust." Job is a plea to see life honestly, clearly, without rose-colored glasses. This is the faith that a woman like Hannah Arendt never understood. She, you recall, is the woman, the psychologist and literary person at the University of Chicago who wrote about the Eichmann trials and could not understand the sturdiness and the dignity of the faith which the Jews took with them into the gas chamber. This is also the faith that many fair-weather friends of religion fail to understand. Religion has a way of becoming popular in good times. People have a way to believe that the affluent society is, in a sense, an answer to their prayers. But religion is not a guarantee. We're having trouble, aren't we? Religion is not a guarantee that God will do good to you, that he will do for you that which you think is good for you. Religion is no more than the statement, "God is. Though he slay me," Job says, "yet will I believe in him." Faith is not a paid-up ticket to a 80-year-long winter vacation cruise. Faith is simply an affirmation of God, of life which can have meaning even though it is unpredictable and stormy. Who will say unto him, that is unto God, "What doest thou?" Now, I began by speaking of Job as congruent with our modern view of life. There is a philosophy which has gained a certain amount of popularity on the academic campus, literary circles, which is called existentialism. Existentialism is a varied and many-faceted thing. But essentially, it begins where Job begins, by insisting that life must be looked on squarely, without blinking. Existentialism begins with a critique of our general and familiar and usual attitude towards life, the golden, the false image which most of us have of life. Many of us, most of us probably, believe that hard work is always rewarded, that if we raise our children in decency and respectability, they will be decent and respectable, that society rewards those who earn the reward, that tomorrow we will have the same good health that we enjoy today, that tomorrow we'll be alive, and that society is slowly and inevitably progressing from the caveman in primitive times to a time of peace and plenty, justice and of opportunity. Now this is a fanciful world, fairyland, a never-never place. And the existentialists argue that when we live in this this never-never land, we are unprepared spiritually and emotionally for the shock of life. What happens when a heart attack takes away our husband? What happens when serious illness makes our parent bedridden? What happens when our child suddenly shows up to be retarded? What happens when fate suddenly slaps us in our face and the world turns to quicksand under us? What happened to the German Jew in 1932 and 33 after the Confident 20s? To live, to have a philosophy which is adequate to life, you must accept, existentialism says, the unpredictability, the bitterness, the tragedy. And you must learn to live with this as part of your everyday responsibility. Why? In the first place, only if you accept the tragic will you accept that which is necessary. Believing that the world is a place of progress and of happiness and of sunshine, we tend to believe that our responsibilities to our children are those of, let's say, of building up a legacy which they can enjoy 50 years from now. Admitting the tragic, we know that the crucial responsibility we have to our children is to give them the opportunity of life itself. Our responsibility is to avoid war, to avoid the ravishings of prejudice in our society, to permit them the kind of life which they have today, life itself. And so our priority of values changes radically and markedly. It is far less materialistic and far more in terms of citizenship. And they say also that we must learn to live with the tragic, with a sense of impending doom, because that is life itself. We raise our children, you and I, in an antiseptic society. How often do they see blood, except perhaps when a ball has bounced off their nose? How often do they see illness, senility? How often do they see tragedy? Do we take them to the funeral? Don't we protect them from all that is basically true and honest in life? And why are we protecting them, if that is life? Mustn't the child know that life is a long walk on the wild side and not a long stroll through the autumn sunshine of Shaker Heights? And only if he is prepared for life as it really is can he make the judgments, the decisions as to vocation, as to priority of responsibility, which are crucial and which are necessary to him. And so there has arisen a whole literature, the names of Camus and Sartre come to mind, a theology, the names of Tillich and Brunner come to mind, the theater of the absurd, which has tried in one way or another to emphasize the tragic, the violent, the brutal, the bruising, the unpredictable in life. And they all claim Job as their ultimate source and authority. Now, existentialism goes much further than this statement of Job that life is a cruel place, that he has been beaten around the eyes and the mouth and the ears for no fault of his own. Existentialism begins with a radical challenge to reason. Reason implies that there is something out there that we can reason about and that it makes sense. Most existentialist philosophers argue that life makes no sense, and that therefore it is useless for us to try and wrench a philosophy out of life. And so the existentialists tend to dramatize the moment, what you do at any moment in time, your response to life, and its honesty and its intensity are values to them. Don't build philosophies. Don't try and use logic to understand what is asked of you. Don't give me, they even say, the old-time moralities. Who knows what's good? What's good is that which is human to you, necessary to you, immediate to you at this moment in time. And so obviously the morality which develops is honest, but it can be any statement of good or evil. Nietzsche comes out of this school, Sartre comes out of this school, Protestant theologians come out of this school, men who emphasize the Superman and men who emphasize the truly humane man. Job who really is not the parent of modern existentialism, never goes so far as to deny that life can be reasoned about. The great climax of Job is the vision of God within the whirlwind. It is God who is beyond understanding. Job never makes the claim that life itself cannot be understood. God, yes, life, not necessarily. Job never denies that there are standards and values, and that we must somehow sublimate these and make these part of our lives. And so in a very real sense, though he begins where the existentialist today begins, he is not an existentialist. To show you what I mean, if you will, turn to the 28th chapter, I think it's 28, of the book of Job. Yes. I want to read it for its philosophy, but you will also, in the reading, sense the poetry and the majesty of the book. Job wrestles here with this very question: is life simply chaos, the blobs on an abstract impressionist canvas? Is life only confusion? Is it, as many men have been saying, that life is beyond understanding? It is the moment, the intimacy, the relationship, the love, the feeling alone which is important, or is there reason? And this by a man who has suffered, been bruised, and who has admitted to himself that he has been hurt and hurt deeply. For there is a mine for silver and a place for gold which they refine. Iron is taken out of the dust, and brass is molten out of the stone. Man setteth an end to darkness, and searcheth out to the farthest bound the stones of thick darkness and of the shadow of death. He breaketh open a shaft away from where men sojourn. They are forgotten of the foot that passeth by. They hang afar from men, they swing to and fro. As for the earth, out of it cometh bread, and underneath it is turned up as it were by fire. The stones thereof are the place of sapphires, and hath dust of gold. That path no bird of prey knoweth, neither hath the falcon's eyes seen it. The proud beasts have not trodden it, nor hath the lion passed thereby. He putteth forth his hand upon the flinty rock. He overturneth the mountains by the roots. He cutteth out channels among the rocks, and his eye seeth every precious thing. He bindeth the streams that they trickle not, and the thing that is hid bringeth he forth to light. But wisdom, where shall it be found? And where is the place of understanding? Man knoweth not the price thereof, neither is it found in the land of the living. The deep saith, it is not in me. And the sea saith, it is not with me. It cannot be gotten for gold, neither shall silver be weighed for the price thereof. It cannot be valued for the gold of Ophir with the precious onyx or the sapphire. Gold and silver cannot equal it, neither shall the exchange thereof be vessels of fine gold. No mention shall be made of coral or of crystal. Yea, the price of wisdom is above rubies, and the topaz of Ethiopia shall not equal it, neither shall it be valued with pure gold. Whence then cometh wisdom? Where is the place of understanding? Seeing it is hid from the eyes of all living and kept close from the fowls of the air. Death and destruction say, we have heard a rumor thereof with our ears. God understandeth the way thereof, and he knoweth the place thereof. For he looketh to the ends of the earth and seeth under the whole heaven. When he maketh a weight for the wind and meteth out the waters by measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for the storm of thunders, then did he see it and declare it. He established it, yea, and searched it out. And unto man he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. First of all, it's magnificent, quite apart from its philosophy. But secondly, we have a statement here that you may not agree with, because it is simply a statement of faith, but it is Job's statement, that there is a wisdom which can be known. It is the wisdom which is embodied to us in the religious tradition, fear of the Lord. And that there is a morality, a right and a wrong. To depart from evil is understanding. And evil is that which the tradition, the religious tradition, understands to be so. So we are not here in some of the more slippery places of modern amorality. We are rather in the world of the Bible, in a world which understood, it felt, what was demanded of God, of man, and by whom. And we are dealing here not with a man who denies God, or denies religion, or denies morality, or denies reason. But the man who affirms all these at the same time refusing to deny himself. He will be the judge. He will somehow come to an understanding. So much by way of a brief preamble. I'm going to come back in time to some of these themes. Now as to a number of facts as to the book itself. Let me begin by telling you a bit about the structure of Job. First of all, Job is fiction. No one ever believed that the book reflects an actual historical incident or an actual historical personality. In the Talmud, 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries, we read already of Job, lo haya, lo nivra. He never was. He never was created. Job was a fictional work. And Job was a work of at least two very different types of literature. The prologue, that is chapters 1 and 2, and the epilogue, the last half of chapter 42, the last chapter, are in prose. All the rest of the book is in Hebrew poetry. And we've discussed the structure of Hebrew poetry over the last weeks. The prologue, the first two chapters, in a sense, set up the confrontation of ideas which the poetry reveals. Job is a good man. Job is an innocent guinea pig for a test of human mettle, which Satan wishes upon God. Satan challenges God to prove that man will worship him if it is not to his benefit. No one ever does something unless there's something in it for him. Job, Satan puts it this way, doth Job fear God for naught? Job is chosen because he is a paragon among men, a man who exemplifies all of the ordinary virtues and a number of the quite extraordinary ones. He has an unblemished moral record, he is a good father, he is a fine citizen, he is respected in the land. Now, Job is put to severe test. The tests come in two different forms. There is first the test which takes away all that Job has, his wealth, his cattle, his herds, his tents, his homes, his children. For all this, Job sins not. And Satan is still not satisfied. He says to God, skin for skin, let me attack him where it really hurts. And so Job is afflicted with some kind of terrible skin disease. Job has no peace. There's only endless, crucial pain. And even his wife turns against him and she says, curse God and die. And Job refuses to curse God. And then we're told in this prologue that three friends come to make a call. We'd call it a condolence call today, I suppose. And they sat with Job without saying a word for 7 days. 7 nights. And that ends the prologue. The poetry begins with the first speech of one of the friends at the end of the 7 days. We'll come back to this. After these series of speeches and the core of the book, there is an epilogue also in prose. And this epilogue says, in effect, and they lived happily ever after. Somehow, after Job has seen God in the whirlwind, the biblical writer wanted to put things right, and so Job is given another 7 sons and 3 daughters. He's given another herd, and he's given another cattle, and he's given another home. He's cured physically of all of his ailments. He doesn't have to worry about Medicare. And he lives happily ever after. Now, what are the poetic portions? Again, they are of 3 disparate qualities. There are a series of dialogues between Job and the three men who come to comfort him, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. They make a speech to Job, and Job responds. After this, there is an inserted speech by a man named Eliu, who is not among the first 3 visitors to Job. We don't know quite how he comes into the story, but he's there. And he makes in turn a series of speeches to Job. And finally, Job, who has responded all after each of these speeches to his friends, is faced by God. And God speaks to Job out of the whirlwind, in a series of dramatic cadences, the unity and the majesty and the power of the universe is suggested to Job. And then we come to the epilogue itself. Now, scholars have tried in many ingenious ways to understand the book. Was it all written by one hand? Or are these separate parts that were fitted together by some later editor? There have been as many solutions as there have been men who have investigated the field. For Job is, for all of its power, the most difficult book in the Bible to understand. The Hebrew of it sometimes defies translation. And I would be less than honest to you did I not say to you that any translation of the book of Job, especially the poetic sections, contains at least 20% guesswork. There are whole chapters at which we can make only the vaguest leap of understanding. So much of this book escapes us a little bit, and that's part of its attractiveness and part of the mystery of it all. And part of the reason that so many scholars can have so many opinions as to the book. Nor does the language give us much of a clue. It used to be believed that Aramaic was spoken only in the last centuries before the Common Era, and the language of Job reflects many Aramaisms, many words which came into Hebrew only after it came into contact with the Aramaic. But in recent times, we have learned that Aramaic goes back into even to the 7th and 8th centuries before the Common Era, the pre-exilic times. And this clue has been lost to us. But I think that a general consensus would be this. The first two chapters and the last are folk legend, very old. On the basis of this folk legend, some great poet inserted the three dialogues with Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and Job. The same author or another was not satisfied to leave simply the discussion between men, but wanted to intrude the presence and the force of God, and you get the vision out of the whirlwind. And then it's commonly believed that the poetic sections, a dialogue with Eliu, was inserted at the very end by a pious poet who was afraid that Jews might believe that God is simply power, the whirlwind. Because Eliu keeps insisting that though man cannot understand God's wisdom and God's justice, there is wisdom and justice in the universe and in our lives. The whirlwind is simply the presence of God, the presence of a power beyond ourselves. God is the tyrant, if you will. In Eliu, God is the creative wisdom of the universe, the father of us all. The Almighty, Eliu says, whom we cannot find out, is excellent in power, yet to judgment and plenteous justice he doeth no violence. That's his key idea. And the reason that many scholars believe that this section is late. Now, what I'd like to do this morning, this afternoon, is to read with you straight through the first two chapters, which set the theme. After we've read it together, to go back over it and try and give you a few notes which may help you in its understanding. And then to give you a series of understandings which I have had as I've read the book of Job at different times. We begin then, Job 1:1. There was a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job. And that man was wholehearted and upright, one that feared God and shunned evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His possessions also were 7,000 cattle and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses and a very great household. So that this man was the greatest of all the children of the East. And his sons used to go and hold a feast in the house of each one upon his day. And they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so when the days of their feasting were gone about that Job sent and sanctified them and rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and blasphemed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Now it fell upon a day that the sons of God came to present themselves before their Lord, and Satan came also among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in the earth, a wholehearted and an upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? Then Satan answered the Lord and said, doth Job fear God for naught? Hast not thou made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions are increased in the land. But put forth thy hand now and touch all that he hath. Surely he will blaspheme thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, all that he hath is in thy power. Only upon himself put not forth thy hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. And it fell on a day when his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, that there came a messenger unto Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the asses feeding besides them, and the Sabaeans made a raid and took them away. Yea, they have slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped to tell thee. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, a fire of God has fallen from heaven and hath burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I only am escaped to tell thee. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, the Chaldeans set themselves in three bands and fell upon the camels and have taken them away, yea, and slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped to tell thee. And while he was yet speaking, there came also another and said, thy sons and thy daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house. And behold, there came a great wind from across the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people. They are dead, and I only am escaped to tell thee. Then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. For all this Job sinned not, nor ascribed he aught that was unseemly to God. Again it fell upon a day that the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan came also among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said unto Satan, from whence cometh thou? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job? There is none like him in the earth, a wholehearted and an upright man, one that feareth God and shunneth evil. And he still holdeth fast his integrity, although thou didst move me against him to destroy him without a cause. And Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thy hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, surely he will blaspheme thee to thy face. And the Lord said unto Satan, behold, he is in thy hand, only spare his life. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And Job took him a potsherd to scrape himself therewith, and he sat among the ashes. Then said his wife unto him, dost thou still hold fast to thine integrity? Blaspheme God and die. He said unto her, thou speakest as one of the impious women speaketh. What? Shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? For all this did not Job sin with his lips. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. And they made an appointment together to come to bemoan him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice, and they wept, and they rent every one his mantle, and threw dust upon their heads towards the heaven. So they sat down with Job upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spoke a word unto him, and they saw that his grief was very great. That's powerful stuff. If you turn back to the beginning, there was a man in the land of Uz. I must insist to you that Uz is not Oz, but it may as well be. Uz is an unknown place. It seems to be a place east and south of Judea. And the important thing is that it is not a Jewish place. And one of the important facts about this book is that Job is not portrayed as a Jew. His three guests, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, are not portrayed about Jews. Indeed, the whole action of the book is not portrayed as having taken place within Judean territory. Now, some have said that a pious poet simply refused to put the heresies and the non-orthodoxy of the doctrine of this book into the mouths of Jews. I doubt it. What seems to be the case seems to be this. Job was known as a semi-mythological, semi-legendary personage in the ancient Near East. We know from other sources in the Bible, for instance, the book of Ezekiel, that Noah, Daniel, and Job were known as three excellent and righteous men from among the non-Jews. If they were in a town, the book of Ezekiel says, remembering the book of Genesis where Abraham asked that Sodom and Gomorrah be saved, if these three men were in the town, Ezekiel says, and the town was as unrighteous as Israel was today, they could save themselves, but no one else. We have found at Tell El Amarna, which is a site in Syria, the major digs of which date to around 1350 before the Common Era, reference to an Ayyub, the same root name as the name of Job. Job then is a folk hero. And Job has been made the hero of an ancient tale which was not at all unfamiliar in the ancient Near East. Already in the third millennium BC, at least 1500 years before this book, we have a tale from Egyptian sources of a debate between man and his soul as to whether or not suicide is preferable to life. He has been mishandled by fate, and he thinks that suicide is the only strong answer to the riddle of life. There are other Egyptian and Mesopotamian parallels to the book of Job. None of them have quite the majesty of Job, and in none of them is Job made a man of sturdy moral character, as he is in the Bible. The Mesopotamian sources especially emphasize the ritual propriety of their heroes. But in all of these stories, there is a conflict between what a man has done, what he deserves as a fate, and the fate which is actually his. In all of these stories, man bemoans his fate, though in none of them does he challenge the universe as directly as does Job. So we have here, in all probability, the wedding of a number of ancient strands, a hero who is known for his righteousness, a confrontation between a philosophic confrontation, which men delighted to argue, and a poetic genius, a master genius, the man who wrote the book. Now, did he simply take down a folk story, the first two chapters, and then add to it? Did he reweave the story, the folk story, to give him the springboard into his poetry? Or did he write the folk story whole and give it an entirely new twist? All this is hidden from us by the mists of history. But it's interesting to notice that the action of this book is not essentially within the narrow confines of Judea, and it is at one with Ruth in emphasizing the dignity and the righteousness of people who are not Jews. There is a direct line from this book, as from Ruth, to the statement in the Talmud that the righteous among all nations have a portion in the world to come. Judaism never arrogated to itself the keys of the kingdom. You won't find it in the Bible in any religion which tries to do so. He who does not believe in Jesus and the kingdom of heaven shall not enter therein, etc. goes against what is explicit within the biblical tradition. The word Job, we don't know quite what it means. There are two suggestions. In Hebrew, the root of Job, Yov, can be read Oyev, which means enemy. Adversary, the inveterate foe, the antagonist who will not be easily broken under attack. And you can poetically find Job in his name. There is an Arabic root, Yav, which means the penitent one, the man who acknowledges finally that God is all-powerful. He sought to set himself up, but he came to realize that only God is really exalted on high. Beyond this, the word Job gives us no clue. It may simply have been the name of a man who lived and was known for his righteousness and then was wrapped in legend and was used as the source. It may be that the name gives us a clue to the meaning of the book. Job is pictured as having 7 sons and 3 daughters. This is a traditional blessing in the ancient Near East. When Ruth is blessed finally, she is blessed with 7 sons. And I think without my masculine underlining of the text that you will see who stood better, at least in the eyes of the men who wrote these books. In verse 6, we have our first entrance into heaven. And it begins, "Now it fell upon a day that the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord." Now it fell upon a day. This day, according to our ancient rabbinic tradition, was not just any day, it was Rosh Hashanah, the Yom HaDin, the day of celestial judgment. And we know that the legend which you've all heard, how there is a scale and man stands before the heavenly tribunal and his good deeds are put into one side of this and his evil deeds are put into the other pan, and then the pans are allowed to swing free and finally a judgment is made. This is a very ancient story reflected already here. There is a celestial assize. A celestial judgment is taking place. And in it, there develops among the judges a difference of opinion, a majority and a minority report. Justice Warren and Justice Frankfurter are having a dispute as to the sociological basis for their decision. There are 2 days in which the court convenes. The second day is sometime later, and tradition has it the second day was Yom Kippur. You know, our ancient legend tells us that the judgment is made where it is clear on Rosh Hashanah. The good men, they're written in the book of life for another year. The evil men, gegesund. But what about most of us who just fall in between? Well, for most of us, our cases are held over. They're taken under advisement. And finally, on Yom Kippur, the book is sealed. And so the legend wove this High Holy Day story into the biblical text. I don't know, and there is no reason to believe that this was originally intended by the biblical author. But Satan deserves comment. You'll notice a little italicized lowercase a before Satan, and below the page, something to the effect, "That is the adversary." The reason for this is clear. Historically, the concept of a Satan, red suit, trident, breathing fire, is medieval. It has its roots in apocalyptic literature, to be sure, but its full-blown literature is medieval. The idea of a Satan, the fallen angel, the angel who is sent out to cover the world and to entice men away from the good, to take the young man and to seduce him to women and to wine and to vice, this concept of Satan is later than the book of Job. The book of Job gives us one of the first uses of this word Satan, and it's very interesting. The root, Satan, or Sat, or Sut, is Assyrian. And apparently it's taken from a royal official, the original CIA. There was a man in the court of the Assyrian king who was called the Eyes of the King. And it was his responsibility to wander throughout the country and to overhear sedition and treason and lese majeste. And there was a man called the Ears of the King, whose job it was to provide the records so that they can haul these men up before the McCarthy Committee and hold them guilty. In other words, he trumped up the charges once the Eyes of the King had spotted the men who might foment rebellion. And interestingly, the Assyrian title is the exact same root as the word Satan. And Satan is described here, or the adversary, as the man who goes to and fro in the earth, wandering about looking for rebels and men who are plotting sedition. So essentially, we don't have the concept of the red-suited devil. We don't have the concept here of a fallen angel. We have simply the concept here of some celestial being whose responsibility it is to wander up and down in the world and to bring back to God a report of how man is doing. But like most CIA agents, he exceeds his authority and he forgets to tell the president what he's doing. And one of the bright ideas that's come to him is that really the president isn't as powerful as he is. After all, he can send a U-2 plane and wreck the relationships between the major powers of the world. He's obviously more powerful than the president of the United States. And if he can foment the overthrow of a government in South Vietnam, he's also more powerful than the president of the United States. So he gets pretty highfalutin ideas, and he's going to challenge God in the White House, beard him in his own place. And so he tells God, you think the people voted for you? You think you got that big majority over Senator Goldwater? You didn't get it. At least you didn't deserve it. They voted for you because they knew that you were giving them Medicare. They voted for you because they knew that you were going to cut taxes. They voted for you because you promised them a government dole. Does Job serve God for naught? In other words, there's a commercial relationship here in the contract between God and man. That's the test. God rises to it. Not very strongly. God, in the book of Job, at least in this section, doesn't play a very strong role. He lets himself be handled. But he allows Job to make the test. He simply selects the victim. Now, in verse 20, we read, then Job arose and rent his mantle and shaved his head and fell down upon the ground and worshipped. These are traditional Near Eastern forms of mourning. The rending of the mantle, the cutting of the mantle, you still can see sometimes what's called kriya, where they took the garment or the tie and they make a cut in it, or they'll have a boutonniere of black crepe, which they'll cut with scissors. The other statements of mourning have disappeared from us. And what does Job say? Naked came I out of my mother's womb, which is true, and naked shall I return thither, which is poetry. Man doesn't return to the womb literally. He returns to Mother Earth. And what we must read this as poetry. The Lord gave and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Now a second test is put to Job. And in the second test, some kind of terrible skin disease is placed on him. We don't know what it is. Some have said elephantiasis, some have said leprosy. Your guess is as good as mine. And then woman enters the picture. Now, you remember the original enticement. Eve entices Adam with the apple, and Adam eats of the apple. In the second enticement, Job's wife entices Job, you know, with the idea of suicide, of getting it over with, and Job does not give in. Man's made some progress since Genesis. But the theme of woman as the enticed, what would the word be? As the one who entices. You can't say enticetress, I don't think. Has reappeared. And it reappears in church literature constantly. Reappears in medieval literature. It reappears in the folk literature, Jewish and Christian, of Europe. And it has a great deal to do with the view of woman, which was held at least until Renaissance times. Woman was not to be entrusted. Was not to be trusted. It was she who had enticed Adam. It was she who tried to entice Noah. It was she who shaved the head of Samson. And it was a woman who knocked a tent pin through jail, who knocked a tent pin through the general's ears, etc. But I must say, man has made progress. We didn't give in. Somebody preached a sermon on this, and he said, you can always entice a man with food, but you tell him to go out and kill himself, you're going to lose. There's a limit even to your charms. And then the three friends come, and the three friends say not a word. And the rabbis suggested that here's a good lesson for condolence calls. It's your presence there which is instructive, which is helpful. But when you come and babble, when you come and tell stories, and you would come and tell the widow how lonely you have been, you're not being very great help. And Unfortunately, the three men start talking at the end of the 7 days, and they really never stop talking. But it's a good story, and it's a good way to teach what is really a good truth. Now, as I prepared this lecture on the book of Job, I reminded myself that I had treated of Job at least 4 times before. I reread these texts, and I found to my surprise that in each I had revealed a different Job. I suppose in retrospect, no greater tribute can be paid to a work of literature. Because what is literature than, what is the mark of excellence in literature, than its ability to refract a new aspect of human experience at each reading? I first treated Job in those difficult days between the end of the Second World War and the establishment of the State of Israel. These were the years in which we became aware of the jugular agony of the Nazi victims. And when we did not know where the survivors would be placed, or if Zion indeed would be reborn. I read Job then as an affirmation of the indomitable will of man. Job personified the staunchness of man, our ability to accept the most cruel of fates and to survive, to maintain our sanity and to build again. Job was whipped and scourged, and he did not whine. Job was beaten and bludgeoned, and he had not broken. Now, God is proud of his creation, man, and the adversary, the Satan, is cynical. Oh, yes, man appears to be virtuous, but their virtue is self-serving. If the respectable people did not expect a reward, if they did not expect the accolade of their neighbors, God, you'd see quite another kind of human being. Job is sacrificed as a test, for he is the paragon among mortals, the best of us. Satan, however, is quite confident that he can break Job's equanimity, break him down, and unmask the less than noble animal within. In startlingly rapid succession, Job is stripped bare. And then the Bible tells us Job rose up, as we read, and rent his mantle and shaved his head, and he fell upon the ground, and he worshipped. And for all this, Job sinned not, neither did he speak aught that was unseemly of God. God believes that his point has been made. The adversary insists on a second chance. He has not yet bloodied Job's own person. And God said, "Behold, Job is in thy hand, only spare his life." And then we read together in quick succession how Job suffers boils and the attack of his wife. But Job turned to his wife, as you recall, and said, "Thou speakest as doth one of the impious women." For all this again, Job sinned not with his lips. In those days, I was reading those scraps of diary and memoir which somehow had survived the Nazi Holocaust. And Job helped me to understand the dignity and strength latent in each of us, which allows men to maintain decency and sanity and even faith, though the fatal knock of the SS is inevitable, and though it is only a few short evenings before the final eternal midnight. Job became the prototype of human staunchness. He and the modern Jobs, and there were many in those days, spoke to me a revealing and healing truth, that somehow despite the most heinous and bitter of cruelties which man can inflict upon his fellow, man can and will survive. It was as a psalmist said, "We are most frightfully yet wondrously made." We have within us a capacity to surmount the insurmountable, to stand firm beyond the limits of endurance. Somehow beyond Auschwitz there would be a Zion. Somehow beyond the eternal cycle of war and narrow peace and war, ever more brutal war, there would be a larger peace, hope for man. Job had faced his future without illusion. The grave, he said, is open for me. Job had not fallen back on the dream of a blissful paradise beyond the purgatory of life. Man lieth down and he dieth, and until the heavens shall depart, he shall not awaken. Job was impatient of all illusions. He looked straight on into the jaws of hell, yet he retained his faith and his courage. I find this a healing truth, although I confess that it puts into shoddy and shabby relief most of our usual complaints. A promotion has been denied us, a club has barred its doors to us, a friend has spoken ill of us, and many of us literally make ourselves miserable over such trifles. Job and the modern Jobs knew true suffering. Job and his modern counterparts had maintained their integrity and neither whimpered nor complained. Job, for all of his pains, dear friends, never took a tranquilizer. I came again to Job during the first years of my ministry, when I was spending much time with the bereaved and desperately ill for the first time. I came to know another Job, the Job who is the prototype of the suffering soul. I was especially struck at that time by the series of dialogues which take place between Job and his three friends who come to console him. The friends try to speak words of comfort, and Job will not accept their words or its premises. As I made my condolence calls and my hospital visits, I met Eliphazes and Bildads and Zophars. You've seen them too. Eliphaz is usually an elderly, worldly wise gentleman or gentle lady. He has seen the widow, and he's seen the widow's tears. And he has seen the widow and congratulated her on her remarriage. He knows that life goes on, and that this living room, bathed today in grief, will someday be bathed in flowers at another wedding. He comes in, he pats the bereaved upon the hand, and he counsels her to hold fast. There will soon be a new life, new hope, laughter in your eyes, joy in your face, love in your heart. Now, Bildad is of another sort. The Bildads of the world can put a good face on any tragedy. Bildad will not look the tragedy square on. Rather, he asks, what could have been worse? And he always finds an answer. We have lost a loved one early on in life. What does Bildad say? It could have been worse. Your beloved was a proud person. He would not have wanted to be paralyzed or invalided. If we are seriously ill, Bildad tells us of others who have suffered far worse and who managed somehow to carry on. Bildad is that cheery sort who braces us and tells us to go on and whom we want to throttle. Zophar is a young person. He has not yet really experienced life, but he understands all the jargon of psychiatric therapy. Zophar explains to us exactly what is happening to us in clinical detail. Good, he says, express yourself, cry, give vent to your anger, curse the world, kick the wall, it's good for you. You'll feel better. Try and understand yourself. You'll come to understand what's happening to you. Keep going, keep talking. All will somehow work out. Now, these friends of Job have their modern stencils, have they not? And yet they were friends of Job. They meant well. They are our friends. Their words are kindly meant. But the important truth is that their words are irrelevant. Indeed, their words are a burden to us. And often their words only sharpen the hurt. Job says, why do you vex my soul? Why do you crush me with words? Some of you have known that feeling. Job will have none of these justifications, for despite their wisdom, their common sense wisdom, they are irrelevant. They are irrelevant to our pain. And yet, paradoxically, these words do help. Though they sharpen the bitterness of the moment, they are not unkind. His friends provide for Job a sounding board for his own explanations. And that's the most important part of any call, to allow the bereaved to express themselves. Read the book of Job, and read especially those dialogues between Job and his friends, and you'll be struck by one fact. Job never answers directly the arguments of his friends. His mind is working on his own problems in its own way. His friends come and speak, and their listening and their logic gives Job the opportunity to speak and to work out an explanation of his fate. So the lesson of the book of Job is not to make a condolence call. Rather, it is to go and to offer what consolation you can, but to offer it without insisting upon it. The mourner will take from your words what he can and what he needs. It is your ear, a shoulder to cry on, and the memories that you suggest that he really needs. Job's friends were out of order only when they insisted that Job must agree with them, that their philosophy must be his. I reread Job some years later and found still another hero, a Job who came to an understanding of the meaning of faith. These were the years in which religion was being huckstered about these United States and with great success, as a money-back, five-year warranty religion. Faith was a guarantee. Faith gave you confidence. Confidence unleashed powers within. Confidence permitted you success. Faith was a guarantee of a better life, of a bigger paycheck, of promotion. You may remember Dr. Norman Vincent Peale and his power of positive thinking. He's still going strong, believe it or not. If you believe, he says, and if you believe deeply enough and pray fervently enough, the inner power comes to the fore. You develop the capacity to be a super salesman. You can join the $1 million round table. If you believe fervently enough, if you pray with enough devotion, you will overcome your shyness and your diffidence. You will open yourself up to love and to feeling. You will gain social acceptance and even the marriage, which is your heart's desire. Madison Avenue has come to religion, only we can do it one better. We have a solution for everything. Now, faith can work miracles, except when faith doesn't work miracles. I remember the young lady who sat in my office, her eyes were dry of tears, for she was beyond them. She sat there kneading her handkerchief. Rabbi, she said, I believed. I believe. Really, I do. I went to synagogue. I prayed. I was desperately in love. I wanted to be a part of this man's life. I felt that if I only I could have confidence, I could win his love. And you know, Rabbi, my prayer did give me confidence. He did learn to respect me. But now he's left me and I'm with child. Faith can work miracles except when faith works tragedy. I used to give the book of Job to those who had been misled by the hucksters of faith. Job believed and Job suffered. Job was a man of faith and a man of virtue and a man who had every reason to be confident of his future. Yet Job's world disintegrated under him. Job had to confront a devastatingly simple question. Can I still have faith if God manhandles me? Can I still have faith if my God does not return kindness for devotion, reward for service? When the three friends come to pay their condolence calls, they are afraid that Job's faith will be washed away with his tears. They are afraid that Job's faith will disappear from him. They seek to explain God's ways to Job. One says to him, Job, understand why God has put suffering into the world. Suffering teaches sympathy. Through our hurt, we come to understand another's need and loneliness. We are the better for it. And it's true. Selfish. People, full of confidence and very selfish, who suddenly had some tragedy and become very active in their communities. Another friend says to Job, Job, have patience. The world has a way of balancing out. Hitler may stand tall for a decade, but he will fall defeated in his own air raid bunker. Have patience, and you will see your reward. And that too is true. History has a way of working out. But the point is that we live now. And if we lived in Germany in 1930, that would have been the end of our lives. His third friend says to him, Job, have a little more perspective on yourself. Each of us being mortal has an ego, and our ego blinds us to our own nature. We think we are good. We think we are innocent and decent. What we really do is to deny most of our irresponsibility. Of course, this too is true. We live in the happy thought that we're God's gift to humanity, that what we do is good and that what our neighbors do is somehow less good. Job rejects all these explanations. Nothing that he has done has merited the sentence that has been placed upon him. Then a strange and marvelous turn occurs in the story of Job. These conversations between Job and his friends are abruptly and without explanation cut off, and God enters the picture. God speaks to Job out of the whirlwind. God offers no excuse for what has happened. He does not say, the adversary and I were arguing about you, and yours is only really a test case. I'll make everything right, up to you and right for the world. Rather, God speaks to Job of divine grandeur and of man's finite measure. Where wast thou when I laid the foundation?
I'm talking into this now.
Right for the world. Rather, God speaks to Job of divine grandeur and of man's finite measure. Where wast thou when I laid the foundations of the earth? Canst thou bind the chain of the Pleiades, or loose the bands of Orion? Didst thou give to the horse its strength? Is it by thy wisdom that the hawk soars in the air? And then Job, after this long and magnificent theophany, makes a most revealing statement. I had heard of thee with the hearing of mine ears, but now I see thee with mine own eyes. I had heard of thee with the hearing of mine ears, but now I see thee with mine own eyes. I discovered a strange fact about tragedy. Tragedy rarely snuffs out faith. One would expect that a man who has been beaten to his knees would cry out and deny. Sometimes I do hear complaint, but there's a stronger truth which sweeps over us at the moment of fear, of anguish, of death. For from our knees we look up, and we see clearly then, beyond the normal world of our routines and of our ambitions, the larger world, the world of thrust, of limitless power, of endless energy. We admit then the world, the power which we cannot stay, the death we cannot avoid, the cycle of life and death which we cannot delay, the facts of life before which we can only bow in submission. My ears have heard the logic of faith, but now I see the power of God with mine own eyes. The moment of tragedy, we come closest to an awareness of the fullness of God's might. We come closest to faith. Faith, my friends, is not an axiom of God's goodness, but an axiom of God's greatness. It comes to us not because we can explain that which happens to us in this life, but because there is life, and because there is death, because there are joys, and because there are tears, because our eyes begin to see the expanding infinity of which we are only the most infinitesimal of parts. There is a professor of philosophy at Princeton University by the name of Walter Kaufmann, who has written a book called The Fate of the Heretic. It's the most interesting volume. He uses in this book throughout the book of Job. Dr. Kaufmann notes how Job rejects the arguments of his friends. He sees how Job confronts the tragic power, as he calls it. And he says, this tragic power and its confrontation is the ultimate truth of philosophy. There is a power beyond us. And this power makes no sense except that it is there, that man must bear it as best he can, with what composure and equanimity he can muster, that man must simply accept life on its own terms. Now, Kaufmann is a modern stoicist, or more accurately, Kaufmann is a modern existentialism, of which I spoke to you earlier. There is, beyond an absurd power, a power which has, there is beyond an absurd power, a power which exists but has no purpose and no meaning as far as it affects our lives. What then of man? Each of us is to strive to make what provisions we can against it. No more compunctions about morality, no more sensitivity to another's feelings. Simply build up your castle as strong as you can and hide behind it for as much protection as it affords. Now, if this position and this understanding of Job has meaning, all the sanctities of Jewish life have no meaning. The mitzvot, the Torah, the learning, the prophecy, the moral passion. Actually, Kaufmann and Nietzsche before him and the Stoics before them misunderstood Job. For the God who reveals himself to Job reveals not only naked power, but purposeful power. He always speaks of the wisdom which has been imprinted onto and into the universe. The universe is orderly and ordered. The world is not an aimless structure. It has form and dimension. And if we cannot comprehend the totality of that purpose, we can still sense it. Here, I think, is perhaps one of the ultimate philosophies of the book of Job. His three friends are dismissed because they have given to Job purely human explanations, partial explanations. They have sought to explain why it is that the righteous sometimes suffer. Each of these explanations has a certain merit in it. We do become more sympathetic when we have suffered. We have seen giddy young people who have become more adult when they have been hurt. There is a strange way in this world in which, given enough time, the wicked are brought low. It is true that our egos blind us to some of our favorite faults. But each of these explanations only explains one aspect of the total problem. What Job does is to reject each of these explanations as a total explanation. Life, God, man can simply not be circumscribed neatly within the categories of human thought. At the same time, Job refuses to give over these categories of human thought. Now, I find myself increasingly surrounded by men and women who insist on thinking in neat and complete philosophies. They call them isms. There's an orthodoxy and a heresy. Truth and deviation. I care not what this ism is. Socialism, conservatism, liberalism, communism, constitutionalism, Ayn Randism, Birchiteism. You've heard these words bandied about, and you know people who are caught up in these theories. The book of Job gives a lie to all of us. Life is beyond theory. We read the beautiful chapter in which Job asks, what is wisdom? Where is the place of understanding? It is not in theology. It is not in philosophy. It is not in any neat human explanation. Behold the reverence of the Lord, that is wisdom. To depart from evil, that is understanding. Ultimately, life is beyond logic. It is not the splitting of logical theories, but the building of cities which teaches truth to man. It is not the precision of one's argument, but the justice of one's law which establishes truth in life. Now, as I reread this last week, the book of Job, I found still a fourth Job, fifth Job. I was struck by the epilogue. Job lived happily ever after. I was struck by the fact that so many commentators on Job dismiss it as unworthy, especially today when we emphasize the negative, emphasize the tragic. And it is written in terms of a fairy tale. But you know, there's an important truth in the Bible. Whenever the biblical text ends on a word which is bitter, damning, curses, a word which speaks of the fate which will befall the nation, the Bible adds to that chapter a line taken from someplace else within it, which expresses hope and expresses confidence. This is done consistently. It's not done from any naive desire to make people go away happy. It's done because man cannot live with hopelessness. Done because hope is part of the wisdom of life. Whoever wrote this last chapter may not have been a great writer, but he was a good preacher, and he was a good philosopher. There is the brutal. There is the bruising. There is the violence. But there are joys that do come true. There are hopes that can be realized. There are dreams that are fulfilled. There are the quiet moments of perfect love. There are those intimate family moments of shared joy. Each of us has known these. And these are as much a part of life as the bitter moments. And any philosophy which pretends to be inclusive must consider these as well as the tragic and galling. There are hopes that do come true. There are joys that are realized, not in a fairy tale sense. Very truly, if we live these disciplined lives, if we perfect our skills, if we are honest in our human relationships, if we are loyal to our families and in love, it is true, I think, that there comes to us, what's the word, peace of mind, peace of soul. The words have been bandied about and lost their essential meaning, but they're good words because they describe what each of us have felt. Moments of complete happiness. Brief, to be sure. Life is a balance. Birth, death. Exuberance, the grave. Joy, sorrow. A philosophy must take into consideration the balance, and not only the dark and the black and the red. And so I find in this era that we are emphasizing confusion and violence, tragedy and despair, that this last half chapter of the book of Job speaks to me a truth worth the speaking, and a truth which I think helps to put the entire book in its proper perspective. The floor is yours. Questions, comments? Yes.
I'm talking about a term. I mean, it may not have anything to do with this, but is it true it's a I don't quite. In the wedding ceremony? Question is it true that in a wedding ceremony you're told not to laugh too much or cry too much? Well, the sharing of a single cup is a reminder that there is the bitter and the sweet, and you must share as one whatever life holds in store. Yes, we try and balance out the emotions. Alibi. More about existentialism. Existentialism is one of those cover words which covers a whole variety of thinking. There is a truth within it, as within most things in life. And the truth is that most of us refuse to look at life for what it is. Life to us is the fairy tale that our mother read us where everything lived happily ever after. Existentialism insists on the brevity and the shortness and the tragic in life. But it can be much more. Existentialism tends to emphasize the human relationship as being the norm of all that is good. You know, most of us have been brought up to believe that one way or another, the morality begins with the two tablets of the law, the commandments. And what is true, obviously, is that these are only words, stone, paper, whatever it is. Well, what do they mean? How do we translate them from words into life? Each of these words has in time been perverted to the wrong use by the wrong people who have sanctified their evil with pious words. Now, the existentialists say that all these words are meaningless. Cancel them out. Not that only the Ten Commandments, but all the moral codes and men. They're simply words, and words can be abused, and are regularly and routinely abused. And this is surely a truth which is going to come out in the age of Madison Avenue. Words are abused, then demeaned, then despoiled, and they have no meaning. Peace was used by Hitler to justify his policy. Freedom is used by the worst tyrannies of the world justify theirs. Words have lost their essential meaning if they ever had an agreed on meaning. All that can be truly useful is the honesty of the relationship between you and me, between any two human beings. And it tends to emphasize the immediate moment of relationship. And that's in part of justifying the sensuality and the sexuality of our culture. But in another sense, in a deeper sense, it's insisting that most of us relate to people in terms of what we can use them for, rather than in terms of the fact that they are human beings who share life with us. Our language gives us away. You don't like somebody, what do you say? I have no use for so-and-so. I can't find a way of hooking him in to my own needs and desires. And I think it's true. Most social life, I'll excuse any party you're planning this week, but most social life occurs because you want people who are important to your husband's business, or you have to entertain customers, or you are repaying somebody who tried to use you and now you're trying to use them. Or you want your husband to be able to pick up a phone and call so-and-so without having to go to his secretary and not being able to get into the office. Most of our relationships with people is demeaned and degraded because we put it to perverse use. Friendship is very rare. Just the fact that you like a human being and you joy be with them. There's no ulterior meaning and purpose to it. And this philosophy, especially in its Buberite, Martin Buber, development emphasized the importance of seeing the other person as a thou instead of an it, as somebody who could be a pleasure to you rather than somebody who is of use to you. Now, existentialism, however, includes many elements which are unfortunate. It is one thing to say words are of use. It is another thing to say that words are useful. They're the only kind of communication that we have. And as you know from these erotic novels which make man's lust the only avenue of formal communication between people, this is no way in which the society can unfold. Reason is useful. Reason is useful. The fact that men abuse words does not mean that men cannot use words usefully. We need reason. There will be no progress without reason. The existentialist talks about the dramatic confrontation of your destiny, the act of the moment. Existentialism can perhaps be best summed up in the dignity and the futility of a man taking a sailboat to cross the Pacific to place himself in the path of a atomic bomb test, in the hope that society will not hold the test. There's the act of a man protesting against the vulgarity and the brutality and the criminality of organized government in the 20th century, making an act which he really consciously knows to be futile, but if there's a nobility to it. And he loses. And that's the tragedy. A Navy patrol boat comes up and takes him aside and simply led away. Much of the tramping around and the burning of such wings have been of draft cards, etc., has been encouraged by some of the less desirable elements within existentialism. Because it, through its literature, it encourages man to confront the universe, to make this bold gesture precisely because it's absurd. That's the stigma. Now again, society cannot be, has such anarchy within it. We must learn to use these gestures so that they are meaningful, and we must learn to cooperate so that all of us move forward in a common direction. Now this attack on reason in favor of emotion, this attack on the reasonable life as opposed to the ecstatic life of the moment, leads to, well, you'll see it most when your children are in college, and when they say to you, why should I go bother going on? Why can't I spend my summer in Mississippi and my winters in the Peace Corps? Why must I make plans for the future? And you have no answer for them. Because what they're asking is good and right. But there's wisdom on your side, too. Because as the Peace Corps advertisements themselves say, you can't make a future in the Peace Corps. What happens 10 years from now, in 20? Somehow, between the moment and the life pattern, we must make a balance. The balance must be more for the moment than we've made it up to now. But your wisdom, the wisdom of parents, let's say, is as appropriate as theirs. Now, existentialism can go beyond this. Existentialism denies that there is philosophy, that there is something out there which can be reasoned about. As a result, existentialism can be a denial of communication between people. And man is almost put and sealed off from himself. You get Herzog out of this. A man who has no ability to relate to people except to write letters to himself. Since we really cannot communicate totally with another human being, you're left communicating with yourself, and that's madness. There's some of this in the book of Job. I point to you the fact that though we think it would be the cruelest of fates to have our children killed, Satan quite aptly points out Job hasn't yet been struck himself. true, isn't it? For all of our posing about parent, being parents, we can see this again and again in history. We have a capacity to survive. We are not yet struck. They are already individuals outside our body. Existentialism turns us in on ourselves. It borrows here from the techniques of modern psychiatry and psychology and all kinds of things of this type. And it makes it difficult for us to relate to one another. One of the reasons I think that many modern preachers have given up their sense of the sacredness and the importance of the pulpit is that there is an existentialist theology, and that many of them are deep down members of this kind of attitude, and they despair of ever communicating between one another. And of course, every preacher has had the experience of listening to his overhearing his congregation talking about what he has said, and realizing that any resemblance between what they got out of it and what he said is purely coincidental. But I hold that doesn't mean that you stop trying. Because what else have we? How else can the mass society relate to each other? Thoreau is a noble ideal, sort of a primitive American existentialist. But we haven't got ponds anymore. And we haven't got the wilderness to permit 195 million people to live as he did. We are bound to the city. We are bound to the apartment towers. We are bound to a mass society. And we better learn to live within it. Well, I could go on. The very fact that it's an existentialist theology means that some men use it to prove God, and some men use it to prove there is no God, because it's existentialist atheism. There's an existentialist communism, there's an existentialist capitalism. You can make it into what you want, as long as you emphasize the tragic and the moment and the relationship. I would agree with you completely. This is another understanding of the book of Job. One of the interesting things of the Bible, and this Kurzweil brings out, is that man is not a slave to God. Come, let us reason together, Isaiah says to God. Abraham challenges God. Why could he pronounce the doom of Sodom and Gomorrah? And he hundles down God to the point where at least if there's 10 righteous men, the city will be redeemed. Man does stand up to God, and you can certainly make another, like, I presume that I'll speak on the book of Job 100 times more in my ministry, and I'll have 100 other elements within it to emphasize. It only takes so many. I'm sorry. I didn't hear the first one. Do I think that Job has shaken faith in God is out of love or fear? I think he's out of fear. We spoke about this last week. It's interesting, it keeps coming up. And I said last week something which, for many of you, blows up a bit on this. But I think that fear is a very important element in faith. I think we have moderated, you know, and blunted most of our emotions. The ancient knew fear because, as I said last week, he knew what it meant to live with a taskmaster, live with a tyrant, live with an absolutist monarch. And so when he thought of God, he thought in these terms. But going deeper than that in the book of Job, I want to answer you this way. The universe is a fearful place. Life is really a fearful thing. I love life. I'm in love with it. It's a thrilling adventure. But I'm afraid of it. Someplace in each of our worlds is a Van Allen radiation belt. When you try and go too far, it gets hold of us and it kills us. Somehow in each of our worlds, there's a Satan, an adversary, who turns on us. How many years have we got? How many years before our mind gives way? How much will we be able to accomplish? Why that gnawing fear that we're not doing enough, or that we're on the wrong way, or that we ought to be doing something else? All this is part of life. Job thinks of it in natural terms. The universe, the expanse of space, the thunderbolts, the lightning, and the thunder, and the volcanic eruption. We think of it less in these terms, but this is still very true. But more in terms of the finality of life, the finality of health, etc. We fear life, if we're honest. I do. If his faith was so strong in God, why was he afraid? I said last week that I thought that fear and love are the terminals of a circle which point are almost together. And I spoke last week a little bit about the fact that in terms of our psychological knowledge, we know that in the marriage relationship, let's say, love and fear play equal elements. I think that this is true in terms of faith. I have faith in God. Let me speak very personally. I have faith in God. Now, I know that this faith could tell me that nothing that's going to happen is too tragic. But it's going to happen to me. Therefore, it's tragic. Because I lack the wisdom and the philosophy to explain it to myself. The two are one. I think we've had too much talk about creating a fumigated adolescent faith that we can teach our children. As a matter of fact, our homes in the last 50 years have all been guided by this concept of love. Surround your child with love. Love until he becomes an adult. If you love a child enough, then you're going to prevent him from becoming an adult. Love is only part of what he needs. He needs authority. The Bible says that a man who withholds his rod keeps his child. I'm getting tidbits from my own family over here. But I think it's true. Children respond to authority. And some of it is simply the expression of your personality. How much you rationalize it as doing it for his benefit. I would think it'd be a very pallid and sickly place if we all went around loving one another. And a home in which love gushes out is a bad place for children. All the grandmothers are clapping and the mothers are clapping. There's a balance, of course. Yes. Is there anything in the book of Job which says that when a man is surrounded by abundance, he is less likely to have faith? No. As a matter of fact, the reverse question is a question posed. Job has abundance, has affluence, and he has faith. The question is, will he keep him when he doesn't have? Not the reverse. Do I feel that this is so? No. The reverse is, I think, is true. I think the more desperately men have lived, the more they tend to have faith. And that the reason this is so is that most people are too dull, too self-involved, to even worry about it. that everything is going well. I'm constantly amazed by the absolute indifference to life which most people exhibit most times that they are alive. It's good. And of course, if things are going well, why not? Even though Job isn't known as a Jew, wouldn't we know it as a Jewish book by its concept of faith? I'm sorry. That was going to be an easy question to answer. Yeah. Well, this is the last question, and then we're going to go, so I'd appreciate if you stay seated until we're through, because I can't answer over the click, click, click of your heels. Is it a Jewish book because its concept of faith, and its concept of faith is obvious, as Henrietta suggests, one of complete surrender to God? Well, first of all, it becomes one of affirmation of God, but he never surrenders to God. That's what makes it Jewish. He surrenders to God only when God has proven a faith. It's not a blind surrender. It's not a leap of unreason. It's a leap of reason. Well, the story of Abraham and Isaac is unreasonable on the face of it, on the surface of it. This story is, we take it in its own terms. The Jew has never believed in blind faith. The Jewish believed in profound faith. There's a difference. The difference is as to how you got there and how you keep developing it. Job demands understanding. In his own terms, he got it. We demand understanding of other questions. We hope and we pray in our own terms that we will get it. We don't say, credo, creed, absurd, and I will believe because it's absurd. Or it is the very illogicality of faith which establishes its truth. Faith is grounded in that which is reasonable. We begin with the three answers in the sentence of Job. We grow beyond that. And we make a leap perhaps beyond that. But the groundwork must be reasonable. And you do demand that reason. Well, it's been fun. And next week we're going to talk about the most difficult book of the Bible. What else but Daniel? Now see you then.